Okay, hi everyone. This is the VA reading group. We're continuing our reading of the book whose title I can never remember, the one on cybernetics. We finished the introduction and we're starting on chapter one. So this is page 19. Yeah, cybernetics and the origin of information. Thank you. So we're on page 19 of the translation. And so the introduction has mostly been sort of a very sort of big picture criticism of some of the assumptions of cybernetics. So he talked about this concept of information and made some similar criticisms to the ones that we saw when we were reading Simondon. So the fact that this sort of communication engineering definition of information makes like a completely random text, for example, just a sequence of random letters and numbers or whatever, the most have the highest information content of any possible text, and then a structured text in English or French or whatever is contains much less information because it's not fully random. There's like a certain amount of structure that allows you to predict, what letter comes after the first one with, a certain probability. And this is obviously pretty counterintuitive that like a completely meaningless text is, very high information, and then a text that, has potentially a great deal of meaning is, less information, has less information content than the random text. And then he also talked about this sort of criticism of, I think this is sort of like the general argument that we're going to see throughout the book, the fact that cybernetics sort of extrapolates from the fact that there are these sort of mechanical processes in living beings, including human beings. So of course we have mechanisms like, temperature regulation mechanisms. So if your body gets starts getting too hot, then you start sweating, and then the sweat increases the heat conduction across your skin, and that helps to cool your body down. And then conversely, if you start getting cold, then you start shivering, and then the muscle vibrations that constitute shivering generate heat that helps to keep your body warmer. So you have these mechanisms that sort of help to maintain your body in a stable temperature range. And then cybernetics sort of extrapolates from the fact that there are these mechanisms that perform various functions, and then sort of takes it that a living being, including human beings, just is a sort of set of mechanisms or a complex mechanism made up of these sub-mechanisms. And then so Rouillet's argument is that this is an illegitimate extrapolation, because when we look at machines that we build, that humans produce machines, these machines are always sort of framed by human actions. So a human has some purpose that they want to achieve and produces a machine that can achieve that goal, and then uses the machine, and then at the end receives some kind of benefit, or whatever the machine has done is something that the human operator or user or whatever either enjoys or doesn't enjoy, or in some way has an experience of. So there's a human sort of element at both ends of this chain. So he talks about like this sort of thought experiment of where you suppose that you have like, so in sort of normal radio transmission, he's writing in the 50s and 60s about this. So you have a human who selects the content to be transmitted, whether it's music or an interview or whatever. And then there's this, mechanical or, machine, mechanical in the broad sense, using machines in general, this process that, say, it takes the sound waves in the air and turns them into electrical currents, turns those electrical currents into radio waves. And then at the other end, the receiver takes those radio waves, turns them back into electrical currents, and then back into sound waves. And then a person hears the radio transmission. But then we can imagine, replacing the human at both ends, the person who selects the content and then the person who's listening to the radio. So you have some sort of machine that, generates the content or selects the content to be transmitted. And this essentially exists already today. We have, Spotify algorithms that will generate a feed for you. And then on the other end, instead of having a person listening, you could have, a microphone set up beside the radio, and there's different automated systems that can do speech detection or analysis of music. And then you have this whatever system set up to, take in this radio record or radio transmission And then write a letter to the editor, or write a letter back to the radio station to say this program sucked, this program was great, etc. And then the automated algorithm that selects the content can sort of take in that feedback from the other automated system that listens to the radio and make adjustments accordingly. And this, so in some sense, this reproduces the process that we see in the human case, where a human is selecting the content and listening to the radio. But it's clear, I think it's just sort of intuitively obvious that this is a complete waste of time and effort to produce this feed, transmit it over the radio, have this other algorithm analyzing it and generating a supposed letter back to the first algorithm. Like, this is just completely meaningless process. There's no one home in this whole thing, right? No one's enjoying or not enjoying, or interested in or not interested in whatever is going on here. And so I think this sort of thought experiment is kind of what Rie is getting at in a lot of his arguments in this book, is that there's this fundamental difference between this sort of mechanical simulation of the process involving humans and then the actual process involving humans. And we can't sort of generalize or extend our conception of the situation from this mechanical analysis to say that the human case, the case when there's a human at both ends, is itself mechanical in nature. So yeah, that's sort of the general outlook of the book as a whole. And then he's going to give more detailed analysis of what this means in particular cases. And he's also going to so this applies not just to processes involving human mental life or intention or something of that kind, but also to living beings. So living beings, as I mentioned, there are these mechanisms in living beings, like our temperature regulation mechanism. But for Rie, we can't explain the generation of a mechanism or of mechanism as such on the basis of mechanism. So you can, for example, in embryology or in the development of an embryo, you start with a largely undifferentiated cell, and then that cell, over the course of the development of the embryo, turns into a variety of different kinds of cells and different structures, muscles, bones, nerves, etc. So you have something undifferentiated turning into something differentiated, and so the sort of end result might be mechanical in various ways, but a knee joint with the muscles that move the leg is similar to various mechanical devices for lifting and moving and so on. But you can't explain machines as being produced by machines sort of indefinitely back into the past. The emergence of machines, it can't itself be mechanical for Rie. And so that's the application of the same sort of insistence on the fundamental difference in the case of living beings as well. So it's not just in human mental life, but also in the world of living beings, that we can't sort of extrapolate from the presence of these mechanical systems, like the temperature regulation system, to the general thesis that living beings are completely mechanical, or that mechanism sort of exhausts what it is to be a living being. So that's the general outlook of the book that we will go through in more detail. Okay, so would someone like to read from the beginning of chapter one, please?
I can read. Chapter one, the main types of information machines. In briefly reviewing the main types of information machines, we will consider them from two points of view. What is their value as models of psychobiological actions? And what is their role in the use or possible extension of information? The two main types are, on the one hand, electronic calculation and reasoning machines, and on the other, feedback and self-regulation machines. Machines of the first type process information belong in the field of informatics rather than of cybernetics. Calculating machines. Your typical office calculating machines are based on cogwheels, which move according to the ratios determined by the decimal system. Analog machines are mechanical models of the phenomenon that we want to study. They provide information such as length, rotation angle, and so on, which can be easily translated into measurements of the phenomenon. Machines for solving differential equations have an integrator consisting of a horizontal disk, a roller rotating on the surface of the disk, and a screw that moves the center of the disk relative to the wheel. The rotation of the wheel depends on both its distance from the center of the disk and the rotation of the disk. If, for example, the displacement of the center of the disk measures the speed of a vehicle, and if the rotation of the disk measures time, the wheel will measure the distance covered. Since there is obviously nothing in the brain like cogwheels, screws, or disks, no one can be tempted to find a key to understanding how the brain works in these kinds of machines. Moreover, calculating machines have almost never interested physiologists or psychologists as much as have automata proper. Already in the 17th century, Descartes, the godfather of cybernetics, derived the reflex model and all the essentials of his physiological conceptions from the simplest of these hydraulically controlled automata. But it was not until the 20th century that calculating machines and analogical machines became interesting to philosophers after Pascal and Leibniz, other than for the logistical aspect. Electronic calculating machines, ENIAC, BINAC, EDVAC, Mark I, etc., are designed on a completely different principle, that of electrical circuits that are controlled, that is, kept open or closed, by electronic valves similar to radio lamps. These machines operate not by mechanical movements, but by opening or closing circuits. The current, no current alternative represents basic information, the yes-no of an informative decision. With basic yes-nos multiplied, one can express or learn anything, give or receive any information. With yes-no questions in a board game, one can lead an initially clueless player to find a hidden object, a name, a number, or any arbitrary concept. The photographic or televised image is only a set of well-coordinated luminous yes-nos. The luminous intensity at each point can in fact be reduced to yes-nos, yes-no responses accumulated over time. This principle can be used directly for numerical calculations without the need for cogwheels and gears. This is particularly simple if we replace the decimal system with the binary system on which Leibniz, haunted by the idea of a universal calculus, had already meditated. In the binary system, the dyad replaces the decade, and all numbers can be written with only two signs, one and zero, yes or no. Two will be written, quote, one dyad, 0 units, unquote, or 10. Three, one dyad, 1 unit, or one, first one is not 10, but 1, 0. Four, a dyad of dyads, or 1, 0, 0. Eight, I don't know if I'm saying this right, actually. Eight will be written 1,000 or 1, 3 zeros. 16, 10,000 or 10 and 3 zeros. With four information units, we can write the first 15 numbers. In binary notation, the numbers are on average 3 times longer than in decimal numbering. But for machines that make thousands of additions to the second digit, this is of little importance. And the addition and multiplication tables have an admirable simplicity. And there's a 4-item binary addition and multiplication table, which I don't think it would be very helpful to read out. For addition and for the other operations which follow, the electronic machines use a so-called flip-flop assembly, which uses two switching valves. Closing the circuit of one opens that of the other. The flip-flop cells, each having 2 rocker arm valves, are stacked, and each level by means of the rocker arm allows one pulse out of every two to pass. This consequently corresponds to the writing system of binary numeration, in which the number of units changes after each successive number, the number of dyads after 2 numbers, the number of dyads after 4 numbers, and so forth. The other operations are easily derived from addition. It is also quite simple to transpose the results into decimal numbers. Okay, yeah, this is a pretty, I guess, straightforward description of what he calls calculating machines. I don't really know much about the engineering of calculating machines using cogwheels how early electronic computers worked. I don't have much to add here.
These Halloween versions of the Discord sounds are kind of annoying. This is essentially just an expository passage. He's just sort of explaining how these machines work, and especially writing for a 1915s audience, the functioning of electronic computers would not be, you know, anywhere near as familiar as it would be to today's audience. These were like, specialized academic machines at this point that, you know, they were, you know, giant, room-sized devices that you would, you know, have to book time to use to perform your calculations or whatever, as opposed to, you know, things that we carry around in our pockets constantly. But I think, yeah, the general, I guess, point that he's leading up to here is that you can sort of reduce what seems to be an intellectual operation, like performing a calculation, into these series of extremely simple mechanical steps that, like, I mean, when you think about, like, supposed intelligence tests, you know, IQ tests, they often involve things like calculation, as, you know, this is supposed to be indicative of our of a person's intelligence. But that calculation that, you know, in the case of a human might be difficult to perform is actually extremely simple for computers, because they just sort of decompose the complex calculation, you know, it might be a long division problem or whatever, into a series of very simple, you know, elementary steps of, like, moving one number from one register to another, you know, adding two numbers, et cetera. I think the sort of bigger picture that he's pointing us towards here is that there is a real, there really is this capacity to decompose seemingly complex, seemingly intellectual operations into extremely simple mechanical operations that can be performed by, you know, moving gears or changing the voltage across across a surface or whatever. And so these you know, changes of voltage are intrinsically meaningless. There's no, like, fundamental meaning of, you know, this register being a one and this other register being a zero. But by manipulating those, you know, changes of voltage in these sort of structured patterned ways, you can perform operations that that humans can find a meaning in. So it can be, you know, an image, a sound recording, whatever. You know, obviously you can use a computer for just about anything to represent just about anything a human can think of or experience. You can produce a sort of representation of it that ultimately is just a sequence of, you know, magnetized or demagnetized spaces on a hard drive, right? It's completely meaningless, intrinsically meaningless, but it can sort of produce a meaningful experience in a human user. And so he's not denying that, you know, you can perform this kind of decomposition. He's not saying that there's, like, something that's not representable in these sort of mechanical terms, but he's denying that we can, you know, extrapolate from this mechanical decomposition to a sort of universal mechanism, that there is nothing but mechanism is the thesis that he's going to be opposing. We'll have to see, you know, as we go along, how he gets there. But I think the point here is just that the functioning of these machines is, like, extremely simple, even simplistic. You could say, like, you're literally just moving, you know, these digits, you know, just a one or a zero, you know, from one place to another, using these, like, particular patterns. And the fact that we can perform such a huge variety of operations just in that way is pretty amazing in itself. We can go on to the next bit. So this is going to be the next step of the process. So if someone can read, let's see how long the next section is. Yeah, just the whole next section on reasoning machines, please.
Yeah, I can read. Okay. Reasoning machines. Similar arrangements can be used for logical calculations with a true-false alternative. However, there is no way that the machine can answer quote-unquote true or quote-unquote false, even in machine language, and assuming that translation is possible, if one gives it an isolated proposition such as quote-unquote or open quotes, the sun revolves around the earth, end quote, or open quotes, Pelagianism is a heresy, end quote. The logical truth, unlike the factual truth, is always hypothetical. The logical true and false, quote-unquote, are always coordinated by ifs. A machine can deduce. It can calculate the logical truth. That is, it can carry the truth or falsehood from one proposition to another and operate on B and F as it operates on numbers. To do this, it is sufficient to make setups corresponding to the logical articulations of the propositions, either and, no, or, oh, no, or otherwise, if, then, if and only if, some, everything, and so on. The English mathematician George Boole, around the middle of the 19th century, showed that we can reduce logical reasoning to an algebraic calculation of logical reasoning. By representing the value of the truth of a proposition by 1 and its falsehood by 0, we can make all kinds of operations on the true and the false. The main logical expressions are represented by formulas. If we let P, Q equal propositions of P, like caps lock P, and then the undersize P and Q, their truth value, we will have the following. Okay, this is a bit hard to read, but we have a table here where we have on the left side propositions, and then not P would be as a truth value 1 minus underscore P. Caps P and Q would have as its truth value underscore PQ. Oh my god, this is a bit difficult to read.
Yeah, maybe we probably don't need to read the whole table.
Yeah, it's a table of I guess the calculus of truth values in this system.
Yeah, exactly. The idea is just that you don't need to know anything about what these propositions are, like what the meaning of P or Q is. If you just know whether each of them, like what is the truth value of each of these propositions, is it 1 or 0, then you can give these rules or this method of calculating the truth value of the complex proposition containing the two original propositions. So it's completely syntactic in the sense that it doesn't rely in any way on what the meaning of P and Q are. It just manipulates these symbols in such a way as to generate the truth value of the complex proposition.
Yeah. For example, take the formula P plus Q minus PQ in underscore. It represents the conjunction OR. Indeed, P plus Q minus PQ must have a truth value only if P, the proposition, or Q, the proposition, is true. This is easy to verify, and we get another table. Claude E. Shannon, in 1938, showed that Boole's algebra could be translated into combinations of open or closed circuits. To represent the conjunction OR, it is sufficient to have two switches connected in parallel. The current flows equals 1, yes, true, when either one or the other or both switches are closed. This is the equivalent of the proposition P or the proposition Q. Two switches in series will be equivalent to and so forth. Using this correspondence of principle, Theodore Kalin and William Burkhardt built a logical calculation machine in 1941, which was actually used in the calculations of an insurance company. There is obviously no way that calculating machines, whether arithmetic or logical, can increase information. If the operator is mistaken in assigning a truth value to the proposition P or Q, the machine will deduce the false as well as the true, and will not restore the truth. But undoubtedly, such machines may appear similar to the brain. There are indeed circuits and valves or switches in the brain. The brain may well be only a set of switches and circuits in which a current, which is not electric but electrochemical, always moves in the same direction. The nervous switches or synapses between neurons function like electronic valves, according to an all-or-nothing law. Of course, it is highly doubtful that the brain circuits, while working in a given operation, are precisely set up like the electrical circuits of a machine when it is performing the same operation. When we add, we do not use the binary system, and our neurons do not stack up like flip-flops. When we think with and, or, if, then, but, it is very likely that we do not simply put nervous circuits in a series or in parallel. We have, as William James says, the quote-unquote feeling of but, or the quote-unquote feeling of because. Nevertheless, the fact remains that the two operations, physical or physiological, may be similar if the atmosphere of meaning that envelops the cerebral operations is as insignificant as the emotional atmosphere that often envelops the reflexes. If I break suddenly in front of an obstacle, my fear, which often arrives late, has nothing to do with the assembly that allowed the prompt and appropriate response. A bus driver at a stop in front of a crossroads hears the conductor's bell that allows him to depart, but the traffic light at the crossroads is red. He only restarts the vehicle when the light turns green. There must be some kind of serialization in his cortex, equivalent to the AND of logical machines. Similarly, the driver in the moving bus prepares to stop at the next station, either if he has heard the bell ringing from a passenger requesting the stop, or without the bell, if he sees passengers on the sidewalk. It is the equivalent of the OR of logical machines. The experienced driver has no need for an atmosphere of meaning around these two operations, and an automatic assembly could very effectively replace him. Calculating and reasoning machines also imitate psychological operations auxiliary to logical or arithmetic calculation. When a man does multiplication, he applies learned rules. He consults his memory of the Pythagorean table, and he also entrusts to his memory the partial results obtained. On the other hand, he must be able to read or listen to the data of the problem and express the result obtained. Perception, memory, the consultation of memory, the application of rules, and expression, all these can be given to machines. They perceive the problems to be solved, and their data are transcribed on perforated tapes. They have memories, magnetic tape, continuous wave tubes, that they know how to consult at the right time. Not only do they obey instructions, but they can even choose which part of the rules they apply, thanks to selectors that automatically decide for a series of auxiliary operations, according to the needs of a more general operation, directly controlled by the machine. Finally, they give the printed and verified results. We could easily complicate the presentation of a calculating or reasoning machine by making it truly read instructions by means of a photoelectric eye, and by making it speak the results by means of a vocoder. The quote-unquote mentality or quote-unquote thought of a machine would still be a pure metaphor. The machine can only function. It can never itself determine the totality of the rules it applies, but only a part that is strictly predetermined by its set of assemblies and not really chosen. Edmund C. Berkeley provides the schematics for the assembly of a basic calculating machine that he calls, quote-unquote, Simon, and even offers to send additional instructions to amateurs. This machine uses only a few dozen bulbs and a few dozen meters of wire. It is able to teach us great truths, such as 2 plus 1 equals 3, and 2 minus 1 equals 1. It is able to notice that the first of these results is the largest, or to choose such an operation, depending on whether the first of the two results is larger or smaller than the second. To get a reasonable idea of the ENIAC, or EDBAC, EDBAC, I don't know if I should read this, it is well to remember that they are only larger versions of Simon.
Yeah, thanks. That was a bit longer than I thought it was, but that's fine. Yeah, good thing to read the whole thing because it's one presentation. So the sort of big picture, or like the point of this section, is essentially just that all of these operations are completely meaningless, that, you know, the machine doesn't care whether the proposition is, you know, when you perform these logical operations on these propositions, it doesn't matter if the proposition is, you know, the cat is on the mat or something equally banal, or, you know, the most meaningful thing that anyone has ever said to you in your life. It still has a truth value 1 or 0, and then you can just, you know, calculate what the combinations of truth values are in more complex propositions and arrive at the truth value of the whole complex proposition. So again, it's just like these completely meaningless mechanical operations that, you know, bring about these results. And, you know, even if we as humans who use these machines, you know, find some meaning in, say, like the video that is represented in this digital form, you might watch it and think this is a beautiful movie or a boring movie or whatever, you know, that is not itself sort of contained in the, you know, digital representation, this, you know, file that ultimately just consists of ones and zeros. And I think that last bit where he talks about, you know, this machine Simon that, you know, is intelligent enough to figure out that 2 plus 1 equals 3 and so on, and how these more sophisticated machines like ENIAC, which was like one of the early, I believe that was one of the computers that was used in World War II. In any case, these are like early computers that were, you know, used for sort of practical purposes and not just as like a sort of toy for amateurs. But these machines are essentially just much bigger and more complicated versions of this very simple, you know, collection of valves that makes up Simon. And this is also an interesting point because I've seen people make sort of similar points in relation to things like ChatGPT, where, you know, if you like, I think there's a, it's easy to be sort of convinced that ChatGPT is like, you know, thinking and giving you answers that, you know, it like, you know, has come up with that, it, you know, the fact that it can answer in, you know, well-formed sentences that have some sort of intelligible connection to your question. It can write a poem for you, et cetera. It makes you sort of, it can make you think that, yeah, this is a thinking machine that is like performing these intellectual operations. But, you know, in terms of the actual functioning, it's, you know, similarly, it's like, you know, basically the same operation as the autocomplete function on your phone, just with like a vastly more extensive database of inputs and then much more sophisticated statistical operations to produce the outputs. So it's not just picking what is the next likely word based on, you know, a few thousand, you know, inputs that have been entered by the user. It's like basically all the text on the internet. You know, if I perform this kind of processing, what is the output, you know, sentence or paragraph or poem or whatever that likely would correspond to this. So it's, yeah, again, it's like this extremely simple and mechanical process just at a huge scale, that, you know, as a human just seeing the output and not like understanding the processing that is involved, it can sort of give the illusion that there's some sort of thinking or intellectual operation going on, but it's really just, again, this like sequence of mechanical operations. Yeah, so I think there is a bit of a, like a part of what Ruyer is doing here is a kind of demystification that, like, you know, and especially you see like at this time that he's writing, a lot of these people, you know, who were working on these computers would describe them as electronic brains, that, like, you know, and this was especially sort of significant because of the way that intelligence is taken to be like the defining characteristic of a human being, that we are rational animals, or, you know, intelligent animals. And this is what distinguishes us from all the other animals. And, you know, and he mentioned this in the introduction, you know, if rationality is, you know, what makes us human, these computers are, you know, sort of pure rationality, that like they're capturing what it is to be rational in a way that we are not capable of because of our sort of mixed nature as both rational and animal, then these computers are actually more human than us. They're like sort of the essence of what it is to be human is this like pure rationality. This would sort of lead us to conclude that like the essence of humanity and, you know, the this pure rationality is just this meaningless, you know, manipulation of you know, intrinsically non-meaningful symbols, you know, a one or a zero or whatever. I think it's a good reason to think that is like something had gone wrong in this whole sort of train of thought, that like, you know, rationality as such is just these mechanical processes that you know, manipulate truth values, for example. And this also sort of captures what it is to be human in like the fundamental essence of humanity. And you see this also with, like, yeah, in obviously a different form, but in the same sort of, I guess, like train of thought in relation to like ChatGPT. You've had, like, I forget who it was, I think it was like a someone from OpenAI was saying that, like, you know, ChatGPT already is conscious. It already is like a sentient entity, this is like a pretty absurd statement, but I think, like, you know, the fact that it produces these seemingly, you know, sophisticated answers to your questions, or, yeah, can generate a poem or whatever, yeah, produces this sort of illusion of a mind being behind it, even though it really is just this extremely sort of simple-minded manipulation of symbols.
Yeah, I was gonna ask when we were reading it, you know, whether you all thought Ruyer would say the same thing about ChatGPT and LLMs, but what you said, that makes sense to me, that it's just a significantly more complicated version of similar process being carried out by the Simon machine. And it's like with reference to the point about like the Spotify algorithm earlier, you know, even though it's not like a human DJ selecting songs based on my listening history, the input obviously is like the music itself has been invented by a group of human musicians and not just sort of meaninglessly correlated out of a set of symbols by you know, some machine. And even if there is a like AI generated song, it would have to be something that is trained on an enormous amount of data of songs that have been produced by inventive processes by human beings. And I don't know, I guess trying to understand kind of the what exactly delineates between the human and machine for Ruye. And you know, he one aspect seems to be that like consciousness is sort of always the frame for a machine. Like a machine can't in order not to be a machine would have to sort of be able to like have its own science and its own technology for which it is the frame without reference to sort of being a tool for a human being or a group of human beings. But also, it seems like maybe he associates invention with the creation of information, which would make this, I think, an interesting text to read alongside Simondon on invention, for whom, you know, for Simondon, obviously, as we saw in his Imagination and Invention, invention is always a creative act or an act of synthesis, which can't be reduced to just an analysis of the conditions of a problem, but is I guess, a creation of information.
Yeah, I think it's helpful, I think, to sort of pause to think about like what is it exactly about consciousness here, or that what Rie is calling consciousness, that is supposed to be like distinctive or different from this mechanical operation of symbols that constitutes these thinking machines, quote unquote. And he mentions just sort of in passing here, but I think he comes back to it later, if I remember correctly, but the fact that these machines, you know, even if they do have, you know, ways of like selecting what to do based on different situations, you know, if this set of rules is inputted into this machine, then it produces this output, et cetera. Even if they have this sort of, flexibility to handle different situations, they're still limited to like the sort of like overall functioning of the machine that like the process that reads in the rules and, translates them into, executes those instructions. For example, like we have, you know, machines that are programmable in the sense that you can, like when you buy a laptop, you can install a variety of different programs on it. You can play music, you can, whatever, word processing, whatever, play games, all these different things that are not sort of built into the laptop itself, but you sort of input instructions that you download from some server, and then the machine will take in those instructions and execute them in such a way as to, you know, produce a video game or whatever. But at the same time, the sort of general setup of that machine, like if you sort of go back far enough or like go down to the most basic level, is fixed, that it can only take in certain kinds of instructions, and it can't sort of change its own way of processing those instructions. At one level, it's like just transistors that are, sort of built into the chip itself that operate in a certain way, and it is physically impossible for the laptop or whatever it is to like change its own layout of transistors on the chip. And what Rie is sort of supposing here or asserting is that in the case of humans, and I think also living beings other than humans, this is not the case, that we do have this kind of flexibility, not just to execute instructions or respond to like different types of situations with different types of procedures or actions or whatever, but also to like modify the way we take in instructions or the way we adapt to situations. So you can learn not just like a new set of rules or a new set of instructions, like as a kid you learn how to how to do multiplication or to do long division or whatever. But you can also like decide as a person that you are going to, you know, learn mathematics or not learn it. You can, you know, change your sort of way of approaching a situation and, you know, the way you approach the world in general. You can, you know, people undergo sometimes like complete conversions, changing religion, for example, or like adopting a new political outlook or whatever, moving to a new country. And like all of these things involve some kind of like change in like the general pattern of your life as a whole, as opposed to just like inputting a new set of rules. And yeah, so it's this capacity not just to like take in instructions and, you know, operate following those instructions, but to like self-generate or self-determine what, you know, what kinds of, what pattern or structure of behavior you're going to follow. I think this is what he sees as being sort of distinctive of this non-mechanical nature of human beings, and I think also of other living beings. Yeah, and we're going to see this later on. I can't remember what, I haven't checked what the English translation is, but he uses this term survol, like so in French. So it's like hovering over or flying over something, that like the mechanical process is just sort of taking in one step at a time, one instruction at a time, and doing something and then proceeding to the next instruction. But it doesn't, the computer doesn't really care, you know, whether this sequence of operations results in, you know, a video transmission that is like a good reproduction of the recording, or if it just results in a jumble of pixels on a screen. It just follows one step after the other. And then if there's like, you know, if the file is corrupted and the video is just a jumble of pixels, the computer will just keep displaying that jumble of pixels. And, you know, it has no like way of detecting or way of understanding that this set of pixels doesn't correspond to a meaningful depiction of a scene, for example. And it's this capacity to sort of fly over or see the whole sequence, and then, you know, based on that sort of overview, you know, decide whether this is a sequence that you want to follow or not. That's sort of what he takes to be distinctive of what he's calling here consciousness, and I think also living beings. So that, and this, I mean, this has something to do with finality, this sort of notion of directedness to a goal, but I think it's not necessarily identical to that conception. But yeah, it's like we not only, you know, follow this sequence of steps that, you know, with one leading to the next, you know, and possibly, you know, a complicated, you know, probabilistic sequence like a machine might be able to do, but we can select what sequence we want to follow in the first place and how we want to follow it. And this sort of connects with, like, you know, the Wittgenstein rule following, you know, arguments, where like he talks about how, you know, there's this sort of thought experiment where you have a student that's like adding, you get your student to add by twos and, you know, count 2, 4, 6, et cetera. And then the student gets to 100 and it goes 104, 108, et cetera. And then you go like, what's going on? Why did you change your pattern when you reached 100? And the student goes, you know, oh, I thought that's what you meant. I thought that's what, you know, that, you know, I didn't change the pattern. This is what I always was doing from the outset. And sort of like the general, I guess, lesson of this kind of little scene or vignette that Wittgenstein showed us is that, you know, a rule can only like determine a finite set of instances. But we use rules for like infinite sets of situations. So like if you teach someone to add to count by twos, you are in principle teaching that person to add by two, you know, infinitely many times, or to count, you know, infinitely many even numbers or whatever. But this rule can't be taken to sort of determine in this like mechanical way this infinite sequence, because it just, you know, there are no like the situation doesn't exist yet, right? So you can't sort of say that the rule already determined what you're supposed to do when you reach like 1,758,000, et cetera, you know, some huge number that no one's ever like considered before. It wasn't like included in the conception that you had when you like set out this rule, but we still take this rule to sort of be the guide for our behavior. And so I think this sort of capacity to take a rule that is in some sense finite and extend it to like infinitely many potential situations, and then, you know, think back about like whether this is a rule that I do want to apply or not, or whether I want to change the way I apply it in this new situation. This sort of open-endedness to our human use of rules is what he wants to present as like a contrast to the way that a machine will follow a set of rules, even if it's a very complicated set of rules that includes like sub-rules for different situations and so on. That complicated machine following, you know, nested sets of rules is still ultimately just applying one step after another and doesn't have the capacity to like change what rules it follows or how it follows them. Okay, so sorry to those who just joined, but I am going to have to leave now. I will leave open the possibility if anyone else wants to just continue after I leave. Otherwise, we can stop here and pick up next week. So up to the rest of you.
I was late or what's happened?
Yeah, sorry. So I have to leave early this week. Yeah, it sounds like a couple other people have to leave. So maybe it would be best to just stop here. And then we can pick up next week.
That sounds good to me.
Okay, cool. Thanks, and sorry for the short session, but hopefully, I think next week should be fine to go the full length.
That sounds good. Thanks, Nan. Thanks, everyone.